Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of rumradio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and rumradio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time, and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on rumradio.org.
Hello and welcome. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. Hey, there she is. Come on in, Mom. There she is. Thanks, Mom. It's one person in the audience, and you know, sometimes the way it goes. We have a very special guest today. It's a special afternoon. I call it the Blue Plate Special. It's Greg Williams. He's the producer of Anonymous People. It's a phenomenon. It's a motion picture. I've seen it. It's a full-length motion picture about recovery. Phenomenal. Inspiring. Great. We're going to get to Greg in a moment. I'd like to do our housekeeping. Like I said, this is Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe, which has shrunk a little bit as the GSO, that's not the KGB, but the General Service Organization of Alcoholics Anonymous, has, through the auspices of the Grapevine, which is our monthly meeting in print, has produced a sponsorship book. What makes this interesting, and this is the first time this organization has attempted this kind of information disseminated through the recovery community. Sponsorship to date has always been you sponsored the way your sponsor sponsored you, the way his sponsor sponsored him, the way his, you get the drift. I always like considered it a lot like playing telephone in high school. And as this verbal communication went around, using the verbal tradition to get this information out, something would be added, something would be lost, and definitely something was changed. So the original understanding didn't look anything like it after several generations. Of course, we have the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that book, it gives us some clear-cut direction. Not as clear-cut as I would have liked it to be, but if you really get into it, it's a study. There is clear-cut direction in there, and it's simple, but you got to read the book, and you got to do a study, and you know what? Most folks just don't want to do that. They'd rather just play it, wing it. They sponsor by the seat of their pants. It's a shame, because a lot of people get hurt that way. Bill W. said, good sponsorship can mean the difference between life and death. And so that's what we've done at Rum Radio. We've tried to make it a little bit more specific, and some of my detractors would call it pedantic. I had to look that word up. That means overly detailed. But you don't have to use it all. But the information is there if you need it. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH. That's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Arkansas as a public service presentation. I'm sorry, Alabama. I'm not used to this the Blue Plate Special. This is a special broadcast. So excuse me. I've already explained the reason for my failure. We would like to also acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine, a finer recovery journal that affords us some print space from time to time. Normally, this is when I would introduce Harold, my co-host, but Harold is doing what Harold does. He's a family intervention specialist, and he's working with families, troubled families, in addiction. You know, it's all different. It's right across the board. He gets it all. Dysfunctional, usually the children, the wife, the husband. It's just like it's a quagmire. A lot of it there is addiction that's involved in that. Pornography, alcohol, drugs, it all comes into play. He also goes to the prisons. He carries the message of recovery into the prisons. And we've found that quite a few, or if not the majority of folks in prison, is because of drugs and alcohol. Why is that? Well, because society is pretty tough. Life is hard. Get used to it. And drugs and alcohol are a way of relieving the pain. We think, at least temporarily, and it does, temporarily. It's quite enticing. People don't get that feeling that, drugs and alcohol, boo. You know, they have their moments, and they're very, very enticing, especially initially. Does take the edge off. And until it gets to a point where it becomes demanding, it comes in as a welcome guest and then stays as the guest that would not leave, no matter how you try to get him out. And that's when we get to the point of addiction. So this is what the program's about. This is how we address it. We'd like to start the show with the third step prayer. Oh, a disclaimer, this is not AA. This is not NA. This is not CA. This is Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. That's where nobody will tell you where they hold a meeting. And if you hang in the whole hour, you might think it's Narcoleptics Anonymous. We like to start with the third step prayer, though, and that's found in the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to use the basic text is because that is the root of all 12-step programs. All 12-step programs come from the understanding found in the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous called the Big Book. So we find it to be the template. And I always like to go back to the basic understanding. It always works the best. Other than the first step, most of the other 12-step programs are about the same. They're identical, except for step one, which mentions the addictive substance, and the other 11/12 of the 12 steps are the solution we call a design for living. So this is found on page 63 of the Big Book, and it's one of the first assignments I give a new sponsee once we've gone through the preliminaries. And it's quite a... I take the preliminary as a prospect, which is a sales term, and I qualify the prospect. Once he's qualified, I have it on the website. It's how to find a sponsee. And one of the first assignments I give him is to recite the third step prayer to several men or one man a day for the next 30 days. Ask permission to recite this prayer. And it's for several reasons. One, it gets him used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, he gets to know the people in his group and they get to know him. So there's a connection. Also, the third step prayer is also called a surrender prayer. It encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And finally, the person he's calling might have been thinking about picking up his first drink of alcohol, and the chances he will not. There was no guarantee to any of this. What we have is a daily reprieve, but we do certain things we find to be very productive. And this is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness of those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We don't have an amen in the book on that. We keep it very open to the spirit. It's not a religious program. Every man for himself when it comes to a spiritual growth, but certain things we hold in common. So, Greg, tell us. Thank you so much for coming on. I know you're a busy, busy fellow. I just got to see the movie, the full movie, last night. Thank you for sending that to me. Look at it this way. I already had paid to see it and couldn't make it. So it had a a synergy to me seeing it. How did you get involved with the movie? What gave you the idea to do this movie? Before we get into your experience, strength, and hope, I wanted to find out about what gave you the idea to do the movie. Was your experience from originally coming into the program, or did this develop later on?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for watching. I got into the movie out of my own recovery. I got into recovery when I was 17, and through that process and that journey, a lot of things have happened and you know, opened up my mind to new possibilities and different things. And, you know, recovery's been an incredible gift and allowed me the freedom to do whatever, you know, my heart desires. I mean, I'm really allowed to chase dreams today and find out who I am and what I'm about, and I guess, you know, learn from other people. And basically, you know, what really brought me to the movie was the same thing that brought me to recovery, was learning from people far wiser than I am and really allowed to tell their story and their story of this recovery journey and the next frontier for this recovery movement, which is recovery advocacy, I believe, and taking our experience to sort of the community level, not just sort of the one-on-one level. And that's the heart and soul of the film, and telling the story of folks like Marty Mann and Harold Hughes and Bill Wilson, who took their experience outside of one-on-one work, but really to the community level and the policy level and some of the issues that alcoholism and drug addiction face in our communities.
I see. All right, well, now we have the end of the story. Let's go back to the beginning.
Okay.
Now, when was the first time you realized that alcohol or drugs, whatever it was, did something for you that you couldn't find anywhere else?
Probably 12. You know, I stole a bottle of liquor with a parent's friend's parents' cabinet or whatever, and didn't like the way it tasted, didn't like the way that it made me feel, but it certainly, I woke up the next day and something happened to me. I wanted to do it again and wanted to chase that first drink, and that got chased to marijuana, and marijuana got chased to prescription drugs. And between 12 and 17, it was pretty much a blur for me. I crashed a lot of cars, did a lot of things that I never set out to do or wanted to do, and like our science and the text talks about in terms of having an allergic reaction to a mood altering chemical, really, and that's what happened to me, and so the outcomes of my addiction certainly weren't my intentions, and I nearly lost my life a number of times as a teenager to this illness, and I've lost many friends to this illness. So it certainly is a life and death thing for me and for our friends and fellows. I'm blessed and very grateful to be alive and talking to you right now. And it was through, you know, good treatment and family support and peers in recovery that I get to be alive and talking today and free from my addiction over 12 years now.
Oh, wow. There's a fellow in one of the home groups I used to go to, and he came from a very wealthy, known family, and he had everything laid in front of him. It wasn't that he had any issues that should have caused him to become an alcoholic. You would never thought that this would have happened, but he tells a story. He was driving a car one time, and locally here in Houston, and he drove it into a ditch, and his head got wedged in and out of the windshield. And a tow truck driver came, and, you know, in amazement, pulled him out of the ditch. And so about, I don't know, I think it was like 3 or 6 months later, he's on the same road. He crashes the car again, and again, his head is stuck in the windshield. And the tow truck, it's the same tow truck driver that comes to pick him up, and the tow truck driver sees him and drives away.
Hmm.
I think that story was hilarious. Yeah, it's kind of strange how those things happen. So you said you were about 17 years old between that, so it's kind of a blur. Did you go to college, or what did you do after that 17?
Well, after I got into recovery, I took a year off from college, went to a halfway house, lived there for a while, got very active in recovery and started to get on fire about recovery. And in the meantime, I went to college for media production and, did very well and got some jobs 3 or 4 years into my recovery after graduating college and in the media world and started to do editing and tape duplication and some of those things and started to cut my teeth in that world, all the meanwhile not really talking about my recovery at my job or not really talking about my recovery outside of the confines of my recovery program. And so, the guys at work would go to they'd be going to the bar at night after work and all this stuff. And so I would make up lies and sort of hide the fact that I was 21 years old, 4 years sober. My life was great, but I had this secret still. So it was sort of like my active addiction where I had the face for the cops and the face for my parents. And then I had my own addiction face and I kind of lived two separate lives. And so I got into recovery and I still live two separate lives. And
let me regress this for a second, if we can. What was your bottom? That's why I told that story. That's what that guy's bottom was when the tow truck looked at him and drove away. That was his bottom. I guess it was a form of humiliation and like the light went off. When did the light go off though? What happened? You said near death.
Well,
is that what it took for you?
That's what it took for me to get into treatment. I don't think that's what it took for me to want recovery. Nearly losing my life in a car accident, 45 miles an hour into a tree, hitting the dashboard, all of that, ended up in a hospital, and then I ended up in treatment. I don't necessarily consider that my bottom. I mean, I think that it was certainly a physical bottom, but I think while I was in treatment, I had a number of experiences during that process where I really had sort of this emotional transformation, where this emotional bottom, spiritual bottom, and really, I remember my counselor looking at me one day and she said, okay, so you're going to leave here in 20 days and you're going to go out in the world and you're going to go live in a college dorm and you're going to stay sober. And I said, yeah, no problem. And I never forget, I walked back to my room and sat on the bed and I just had this knot in the pit of my stomach where I just knew I was wrong. It was probably the first time in my life I really felt that I was wrong. Where I just knew that there was no way I was going to go live in a college dorm and stay sober. And, I had a friend who was in that program who was sort of a couple weeks ahead of me, and he was like, college will always be there. Why don't you get your life straight first? And it was sort of that experience that was, it wasn't me. It was certainly didn't come from me. And I walked back into her office. I said, that halfway house you're talking about? I think I'm going to check that out, and I'll push college off. And from that moment on, that's when, my life really changed, when I was able and willing to open the door and accept help from people who were wiser than me and were trying to do good things in my life. And I think for me, that was a lot about my addiction is I had all the answers and I knew it all. And it wasn't until I was able to be humbled to the point where I didn't have any more answers. I didn't know how to stay sober anymore, and when I got that willingness to stay sober and accept that I didn't know how to stay sober, that was really the turning point for me. But it happened for me in treatment.
So in the program, they often say the gift of grace, but you've already, you opted to go to recovery. So you did take an action, though.
Well, I was 17. I didn't really have a choice. I was blessed to have family. I mean, I didn't have a place to live. I didn't have a place to go, if I didn't go to treatment, and I was facing jail time and all of it. So it was certainly some external forces at play that got me into that treatment program. It wasn't, my all, you know, it wasn't all me. I mean, I was a piece of it, but it was certainly great family intervention, great, you know, physical experience with the car accident and sort of, you know, ultimatums from everyone in my life. So it wasn't just me, but yes.
Everybody was telling you, you have a lot of potential. You don't hear a lot of, you don't hear people telling you that after 60 anymore. They don't say you have a lot of potential anymore. All right, so then you go into school. That's a great story. You know, and it's so heartwarming to see someone who came in early on. Now, you came in early on because of more so the drugs. My experience, alcohol is a slow blow, excuse the pun. Where most of the alcoholics I run into, the real alcoholic, is older gentlemen. You know, they're in at least 30s, usually 40s, 50s, or even older, because alcohol is a slower, it's legal and all that. But the drugs have such an impact and drags you down harder to the pavement. That's what gets you into the program much sooner. Is that your experience or no?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly, I mean, I think pain is a powerful motivator, and I definitely think that having that life experience and that pain early in my life certainly got me moving quicker and opened my heart up to the possibility there was another way of life.
So now you finished college, you got your degree?
Yeah, well, now I have two degrees, actually. I finished my master's degree last year in sort of this work, and so I caught fire about, you know, 4 or 5 years in recovery around sort of, you know, I mean, I was doing lots of recovery work and 12-step work and things like that, and you know, still at the same time, attending wakes of people dying from this illness and writing letters to people in jail who really didn't have any business being in jail for what they've done, and they weren't getting any help with their underlying conditions of why they were in jail. And, you know, I was getting really frustrated with the health insurance stuff, with, you know, not being able to get anybody detoxed or treatment. You know, in our state, we had, you know, insurance companies, and this happens in most states, who are just denying care, and people who want to go get help aren't able to get help in our state. And it's like, you know, if you either have a lot of money and you can pay cash, or you're on public assistance and you can get some stuff. But for the 85% of people in the middle on private insurance, they can't get anything. And so it was really frustrating in terms of, you know, hitting barriers and barriers from the social issues around addiction. And, you know, so I got really angry and I started to speak out about it. Somebody asked me to go up to the legislature building in Connecticut, and I went up there about 5 years sober, and me and my dad told our family recovery story to some legislators and to some reporters, and it was sort of an educational thing. And afterwards, this reporter comes over to me and says, you know, can I write a story about your recovery for the Hartford Courant? And I said, sure, you just don't use my last name. And because I didn't think I could in the Hartford Courant. And so I told my recovery story to him, and he wrote a very nice story about the 17-year-old kid who got sober and is helping people and telling his story at the legislative building to try to improve public policy around this stuff. But the first line of the article was, you know, Greg W. didn't want to disclose his last name. And, you know, I had a mentor in my life, and she said, you know, I understand why you didn't disclose your last name, and you understand why you didn't disclose your last name, but who are you speaking to in the Hartford Courant? And so she taught me that, you know, I was speaking to everybody. I wasn't speaking in a 12-step group or to a group of recovering people. And so the general public, when they read that line, they read that I'm ashamed of my recovery and that I'm ashamed about being a person with addiction. And that's what is read in a sentence that reads, you know, Greg W. didn't want to disclose his last name, or in the media stories that we, you know, black people's faces and not, you know, share people's identity. That's sort of what is read. And so that...
Let me digress. Let me just digress for a moment before we get too far. Now, what happened? Did you get a sponsor right away once you had that epiphany? Did you get to a meeting and then you got a sponsor and worked the steps?
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely took suggestions within recovery circles. I actually don't talk about my 12-step experiences too much at a public level on the radio or things like that. That's just a personal choice of mine. But I certainly got involved and took many suggestions in recovery and was guided by, you know, some incredible people in recovery. But I think, you know, at the level of press, radio, and films, I certainly respect and honor those traditions and don't believe that it's sort of necessary for us to talk about some of those things, you know, in terms of when I'm using my full identity. So I don't know if that's skirting your question or not, but it's certainly, this is a public forum, and I don't typically talk about my specific membership in a 12-step group.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, it's not really, I'm not, okay, I could see that. Usually we go through the, you know, you work this to found the sponsor. Rum Radio is a little different format. You're looking at the, you know, the,
right,
the bigger
but
picture.
I'm disclosing my full identity on Rum Radio. And so,
right,
you know, I'm
yes,
Greg Williams.
Are.
I'm a person in recovery. So I'm not keeping my anonymity while I'm telling this story. And so
right.
I think that it's important for me
sure.
to not go too deep into that particular experience, just because it's not relevant, I think, for my conversation with you. I think this is about the film and sort of what the film is calling for, and it's sort of a separate issue than my personal recovery experience, which I'd love to share with people in recovery on a one-on-one basis, and certainly in recovery
sure.
support meetings, I share that story.
Okay, I could see that. Once you usually, most of the folks that we do, I leave them up to them because this isn't AA or NA or anything like that, but it is a public format. Now, Dr. Bob said that there was two ways we could break anonymity. One was in press, radio, and films, because the internet wasn't around then. I'm sure they would have popped that out. In other words, mass media. Although originally AA did produce quite a bit of information in the public format. There was press, radio, and films. They were using that initially. And then they closed the doors, and primarily the doors were closed for two reasons. One is that they were afraid that there would have been such an influx of people, and they didn't have the infrastructure to take care of all these gazillion people that were going to knock on the door. And the other reason was that there was quite a few people of note that went to AA, doctors, lawyers, and the chiefs, politicians, people that would be recognized, and because they could be recognized by the so many people, that their livelihoods and their positions in society would come under scrutiny. And he said the other way you broke anonymity was that if you were so anonymous that the other drunks couldn't find you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's very true, and from my research, it's, you know, it's somewhat in alignment with the history that we present in the film, you know, around Marty Mann and Bill Wilson as he navigated these issues, you know, Harold Hughes as well. I mean, I think it's certainly been a learning experience for many people. Certainly 2013 is a different time and a different place in this world than 1935 or 1940 or 1950s when some of these traditions were sort of developed. You know, in the spiritual piece, I mean, I respect the spiritual priest and the protection of the newcomer very, very close to my heart. I mean, I think having safe places for people who don't out other people and having safe places for people to go that they don't need to have their identity disclosed is really vitally important for an illness that is certainly shamed in society, even if people don't have personal shame around it. I do think there is quite a bit of shame and discrimination that happens. And so I think that we definitely need to protect those principles when it comes to safe places for newcomers, you know, the spiritual humility piece of it all, and all of that. But I do think it's important that we educate people on exactly what you're talking about is that, and you know, why we're speaking about it. I mean, AA World Services just issued a bulletin last week on a documentary on anonymity and in reference to many of the topics we cover in our film. And so basically it's in total alignment with, as I understand it, and as many people in the film understand it, that I am free to talk about my recovery as a recovering person at the level of press, radio, films, all I want, as long as I don't talk about my membership or bring any controversy to a specific program. And
right.
And so... so that's what that's about, is I speak publicly as Greg Williams, person in recovery, not on behalf or a spokesperson for any group. And it's just my personal story, my personal experience. And it even talks about if you choose to talk about your membership, that's okay too, as long as you don't bring, you know, public controversy and you don't do it at the level of press, radio, and film. So you're certainly welcome to talk about your membership, you know, in many forms, but not, you know, press, radio, and films and sort of on that piece of it. And then you know, and the other piece of that bulletin talks about, you know, public controversy and the other traditions around not lending the name to any sort of outside enterprise or affiliation. And so today I advocate around public policies and I encourage people to participate in support of recovery and building communities of recovery, but not to do it in the name of any particular group, because it's our individual citizenship. It's not on behalf of a particular 12-step group, because they wouldn't endorse
correct.
Anything. So
the idea, I think people don't realize that the reason why is that you, as an individual, now have gotten a certain following, have developed an aura of understanding. Many people look at you, and so if you espouse to be in a particular AA or NA or any of the other 12-step fellowships in particular, and all of a sudden you go out after all that talking and after all that work, and you go out, well, what does it do? It puts a black eye on the group that you were talking for. So this way, no one individual speaks for that group. It's a collective agreement, not an individual's agreement. Can you see that?
Exactly.
Yeah, so. That's why we do that. To keep it just, hey, I'm just another bozo on the bus.
That's right. I mean,
another bozo
certainly.
On, yeah, and that's just, yeah, there's no, what they say, that one of the groups I went to, they used to say, there's no big shots in AA. If one shot, we're all shot. So we keep a level platform. And one of the reasons is, and drug addicts and alcoholics usually are anarchists by nature and self-promoters. So once you start self-promoting, I got banned from a group one time for handing out rum radio cards. And the reason why they did it was for self-promotion. You're self-promoting.
Right.
You're not allowed. And we told you not to hand out these cards, but so you're self-promoting. It's my last name's not on the card. We don't care. We don't like what you're doing. So a quick little story. One fellow I gave a card to one time, he says, oh, you gave me a card about 6 months ago. And I said, that's great. My sponsor loved it. It was all over Dallas. I said, I'm glad to hear that. He says, you know where you have where my sponsor is suicidal? I says, yeah. And there's a line, it's the sincerest form of self-criticism, a permanent solution to a temporary problem, and it's also considered a slip. He says, when I read it was also considered a slip, that's when I decided not to kill myself. So how many cards would you put out? You know, I would have never expected that. So, you know, we do more than one-on-one, what a sponsor does and doesn't do, and I think that's the impetus behind us. But really applaud what you're doing. So now you see that this onus, you know, in my experience too, I belong to a fundamental church, and I've been trying to get AA under the roof, and they're not going for it. And, you know, I tell them, well, But they have their own 12-step program. So I tell them, I says, well, if the 12 steps are not a gift from God, why have you adopted them? And if they are a gift from God, why do you feel compelled to change them? It works just fine, just the way it is. They don't, of course, they won't give me an answer on that. But they really believe in their heart of, you have people who've never been addicted, who've never smoked a cigarette or drank a cup of coffee, in charge of addiction recovery. How insane is that? They can't really relate at that level, but that's what they do. And I said, you know, it's really critical that people who are familiar with this, they really believe that it's about willpower, that it's about bad people trying to be good or evil people trying to get good. You know, they don't get, you know, if they get, you could stop, because they don't have an addictive phenomenon. Although there's some pornography that's been flying around too, which is, you know, that which is a pretty big deal, going behind back doors. But they throw everything in together. Anyway, I believe that's the general consensus about addiction, and it still is even to this day. People who do not have that problem, they're not excessive compulsive to some degree, they just don't get it. They don't see it as a disease. You could have the AMA, you can have reams of information. They just believe, since they're not able, they can put down a drink and they don't have that problem, they can't relate to a person that does. Is that what you find?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it, part of it too, is as we cover in the film, is the language piece. I mean, I think, you know, I don't relate to a woman with breast cancer who's had breast cancer and survived breast cancer. But I can understand that experience when a breast cancer survivor gets up there and talks about the struggle, and I can empathize with her, and I can understand that, right? And so I think there's a different level of empathy and understanding, but I think the recovering community, we in 12-step groups especially, we've traditionally always spoken a language that the rest of the world doesn't understand. We've spoken in a language as, you know, grateful recovering alcoholic or grateful recovering drug addict. I mean, we use terms that if you test this in the general public, it's gobbledygook. It's stuff that people don't understand. I mean, you take a stigmatized word, you throw the word grateful in front of it, and what does that mean to the general public? And so I think part of that is, when we're speaking to people who aren't afflicted and people who are connected loosely or indirectly, because everyone's impacted, but some people have different connections to this, and obviously a lot of people have a lot of pain around this, I think changing the dialogue and changing the language that we use in those forums is really an important step for the recovery community to understand that if we don't like stigma, if we don't like discrimination, we have to stop using language that is of stigma increasing and discrimination.
It stigmatizes, that's right, yeah. We're right. Inviting the stigma with our right. with our language. Absolutely. When I first came in to the program and I said that I was an alcoholic, I couldn't get it out. I mean, it stuck right in my throat, and I couldn't say it without also saying addict. I used an addict chaser to swallow it down. So that lasted for a while. And then I said that in a meeting one time, one of the old timers says, we're just singleness of purpose. You got to get rid of the addict part of it. And then later on, I realized that, you know, where it's a negative self-talk. I keep reinforcing the negative to my subconscious. What good is that going to do? That gets me nowhere. That puts me at stall or worse. So then I came up with grateful, but now after this, I could see that this is even a better way that, hi, I'm in long-term recovery. Or I've said in other meetings, hi, and I give my name. I give my full name in the meeting, and I say, hi, I'm Joseph G., and I'm a refugee from several 12-step programs. I usually get a laugh on that one.
Yeah, and I'm not, and I think there's an important distinction to let people know is, we're, you know, what I'm speaking about and what the people in our film speak about is the language that we use outside of our recovery community. So if you are inclined to speak publicly, It's certainly some people have chosen to change the language inside the recovery community, and that is, I'm all for it. I personally haven't changed the language that I use because that community understands me and they understand that what I mean when I say I'm an addict. But the rest of the world doesn't understand that, and so I need to speak in a language that they understand. And so Faces and Voices of Recovery certainly has created a set of language that is research-based. It's not their opinion or my opinion. They tested this. They put it out to the public opinion. They tested different words. They tested the word addict, alcoholic, survivor. They tested all of these words, and this is the language that they've developed for the recovery community who wants to speak publicly, whether it be at a school, whether it be on the radio, whether it be at a community forum where you're electing public officials or a board of education meeting. So they've created this language for people who want to share their personal recovery story in a forum outside of the recovery meetings that doesn't stigmatize and actually, frankly, makes me feel more empowered as a person and unified in my identity, because when I say I'm a person in long-term recovery, people know what that means and I can define it for them, and they don't take a step back like they used to, you know, when I'm a drug addict, you know, or I'm an alcoholic. So, because people, when you use that word, they think we're still using or we're still drinking, and that's not what my intention is when I share my recovery status with people. And so I need to really be thoughtful about the language that I use and how important the language is. And, you know, Harold Hughes in the film talks about, you know, when do I get well, you know, and talking about that. And so I definitely think that language is such a vital issue for us to talk about as a recovery community.
That's interesting, yeah, to delve out it. What I really enjoyed about the film was the history. I really enjoy the history, how the pioneers did it. And it seems like this kind of enthusiasm had been generated prior, like, you know, Marty Mann and doing all that. And it seemed like it was starting to catch on. And then Reagan comes in with the war on drugs. And, you know, they had that whole thing that anything we oppose grows. You know, nothing grows without opposition. So when we're opposing the drug on war, we're just increasing the drugs.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that it's important for us. I mean, I think people learn a lot about history when they get involved in 12-step groups specifically and recovery groups. And we're taught a lot about how those groups started and, you know, Dr. Bob and Bill and Ebbie Thatcher and the Akron Hotel, and we're taught a lot about that stuff. But no one really ever taught me who Marty Mann was. And I have to say this really assertively and maybe in a blunt way, but she probably reached more alcoholics than Bill Wilson did. And I say that because I probably wouldn't be alive without her. And many people, if your recovery started inside of a treatment program, treatment is really Marty Mann was the one who started most of the treatment programs in a way, because she went to the medical community and said this is a medical issue and we need to adopt it as such, and as well as the prevention of alcoholism and addiction. I mean, some of us don't believe that prevention is possible. It's certainly possible, and there is a lot of good prevention that's being done in communities, and a lot of that spurred from this woman who was the first woman in AA to get sober, and I think that we don't learn enough about that piece of it and what she did. And by the 1950s, Edward Murrow, who was a famous radio person,
oh, sure,
you may be familiar with.
I'm old enough. Yeah, I'm old enough to know, but I'm sure a lot of folks, yeah, they've never heard.
But he was one of the most famous radio broadcasters of all time, and he did a radio show in the 1950s about the 10 greatest living Americans, and he had Marty Mann on that list. And she transformed alcoholism in a way, and she did it by using her personal story. And she, you know, put it on her sleeve, she put it on her back and said, I'm going to talk about my recovery. And so we have clips in the film from her, and then there's also Harold Hughes, and Bill Wilson himself testified at a 1969 hearing in Congress. And no one in 12-step recovery or recovery has ever taught me about that history. You know, they taught me a lot about my other history, but no one ever taught me about that history. And I think that's an important piece to educate people in the recovery community just about it's okay to practice this principle in all of our affairs, and it's okay to be a citizen, and our founders did it, and it's okay, and we kind of have lost that because of what you mentioned with the drug war, and we, you know, it's no accident that the recovery community went back underground as we were coming up in the 1960s and 1976 with Operation Understanding, and so where 50 prominent Americans stood up and proclaimed their recovery status. And so, but in the 1980s and the 1990s, we had this explosion of a criminal justice approach to addiction, and it's certainly a media barrage around addiction and sensationalism. And so we changed our approach, and the recovery community felt the impacts of that, and we started to get confused over anonymity in a little bit more way, and we started to get a little more secretive. And, you know, today most of our social systems have no connection with 12-step groups or the recovery community as a whole, any pathway to recovery, like they did in the 60s and 70s, you know, with volunteers going into hospitals and jails and courts and things like that. I mean, many of us know people who do that, but not with the same freedom and the same permission that we used to be able to do it. And some of that's because of, you know, the evolution of the social systems and not allowing volunteers and whatnot, uneducated, that kind of thing in there. But a lot of it has to do with just, you know, recovering people not wanting to take their experience outside of, or not knowing how. Of the context in which they lived it, and so that's what this new recovery advocacy movement is all about, and that's what's gotten me fired up over the last 5-6 years, and that's what the film is about. So I hope people are looking forward and learning more about that. We have a new website up called ManyFacesOneVoice.org, or you can Google the anonymous people, and that it will come up too. But we have certainly some tools out there that help people learn more about it.
So what's your long term with this? Okay, so you're hoping this is going to start a groundswell of understanding. Now, my experience, most folks in the program are really not all that familiar with the traditions. They're just not. They use the sound bites they see on the wall, and then they kind of just go from there. They don't really get in. They don't really study. You know, if you want, it's always been, if you want to hide something from an alcoholic, you put it in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So most folks are just, you know, they're doing it with a wing and a prayer. Sponsorship is huge like that, where, you know, you sponsor the way you sponsored you, so we use all that. Or, yeah, I'll sponsor you. You have to do 90 meetings in 90 days and don't do any changes. And, you know, this whole litany, we don't want any, you know, go to the meetings, meeting makers make it, so everybody's going to the meeting. There was one girl recently at a home group, the primary here in Houston, that was her sixth meeting for the day, and she was having a real hard time. Of course, she still felt really bad, but the reason why she went to six meetings was because she was taught that the solution to recovery was in the meeting. Not in working the 12 steps with a sponsor. You get into that at all?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that I mean, I think that's the first place that this movement is going. And you know, certainly education is huge. Education is huge within the 12-step community to carry a message. And education is huge within recovering people to carry a message to other people outside of this. And, you know, if there's no knowledge that there is anybody in recovery, then how are we attracting anybody? And there's a reason why some of the membership stat numbers in these groups have plateaued over the last couple decades. And we haven't seen a mushroom growth like we did in the early days of some of these programs. And I think there's certainly things that we need to look hard at as a community and say, you know, well, why aren't, you know, membership growing, and what is holding us back? And so this recovery advocacy movement is a piece of that. It's filling the broken holes in our broken system around how we get people from the social sectors to recovery and to the recovery community. I mean, I think most people who will share their recovery story have an interaction with a hospital emergency room, or they have an interaction at a courtroom, or they have an interaction with the police officer, or they have an interaction with a prison, or they have an interaction, you know, at school. So people don't just stumble upon trying to find recovery without external forces in play. And I think we certainly, you know, individual awakenings and things like that are hard to kind of figure out and put your hand on, but we can certainly better facilitate how people find recovery and how they can get directed towards recovery solutions rather than criminal justice focused solutions. And so I think we just have to think about that in terms of you know, are we being of maximum service and how are we reaching the next suffering alcoholic? I mean, Bill Wilson in 1965, it's one of his most famous addresses to the Fellowship of AA, and he spoke, and we use a clip from the film, but he spoke about all the alcoholics we weren't reaching. You know, all the yeah. success that AA had had up until 1939 from 1965, so it was great. They were big. You know, the Fellowship was big, but there was many alcoholics he was concerned about because we weren't reaching them. And, you know, he even offered that AA might not be for all of the alcoholics. He said that there's certainly people that need some other things and might not fit in our fellowship, but we shouldn't turn our backs to them, and we should find them what they need to get into recovery. So he was very, very concerned globally and domestically about getting stalled out as a recovering community around how we reach the next suffering person, and that was his charge to you know, that international conference at that time. So I encourage anybody to listen to that address and really understand where there is connective tissue between this new advocacy movement and sort of our early recovery movement pioneers.
2 points, one on the growth of AA in particular, but all the 12-step recovery programs. And 1981 was sort of the peak year. The GSO, which is the General Service Organization, did a census. And, of course, this is a worldwide census, and at best it's counting cats, granted. They came up with 2 million folks in the rooms of AA. Well, they did another census, which I was kind of surprised, and I verified this 3 ways from Sunday. Matter of fact, even the folks from the GSO was visiting, and I got to chat with them about it. And 1981 was 2 million. They did another census in 2010, January of 2010. Any guesses how many?
2 million.
2,100,000. In 29 years, yeah, you're one of the few that ever get that. In 29 years, we flatlined. The world population had gone up by a full third. Of course, you had the war on drugs, so there's more drugs than alcohol.
Yeah, can you send me that too? Like, I'd love to include that in the messaging, because I have those numbers and I knew those numbers, but it's an important point. I think it's a really important point when we're talking to the 12-step community. Because it's facts. I mean, we are not, if this isn't your opinion, this isn't my opinion, this is a fact that we grew from A to B, but now we're at C, and B to C was much smaller than A to B, and there's many reasons for that.
Well, yeah, there is, and some of it isn't just because we're not reaching, it's just that there's a many 12-step, there's like, somebody said there was 118 variations of the 12-step program. Every church and every street corner's got a 12-step program, and some people get sober because of the love of Jesus. Some get sober because they can white-knuckle it. I've known a few of those. They're crazy, but they're not drinking. They're crazy as loons, though. So there is factors involved with it. But if you figure the whole third deal, one-third of the world population, if we flatlined, we should have been at 3 million. That's a million people that we miss right off the top. Now, what happened? Are these dead? These are dead people. These are folks that made it to the graveyard. I mean, if they're not there, they got to be somewhere. They're not with us. The other point was Bill, in his last statement, I don't know if you're familiar with this, he makes the point, this was his last address, and he was half dead by the time he got up there, and made it under really strenuous circumstances. And his last address, he said, AA will change. He says, AA must change. And I believe the things that we're doing now on the internet, your movie, widening the field, this is the change that he was talking about. His vision, you know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it has a chapter, A Vision for You. But Bill had a vision, too. Bill's vision that this was going to be a social change, that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was going to cause a fundamental change in world society. That by adhering to these 12 principles, I like to think of them as the repentance process. And that's what they are. What we've done on Rum Radio is we've taken that and we've taken spiritual principles and produced them as a understanding to children. Simplified it. Hey, here's a simple concept. Why these things work. There seems to be a movement. See, tell me if you find that. And I wrote to that on Rum Radio. AA threatens to fire God, demands more benefits and less participation. I don't think so much it's AA, although I see it in the rooms. Clancy I had mentioned that he saw that in pockets. We have quite a bit here in Houston.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the beautiful components of 12-step recovery is certainly the diversity, you know, and the group conscience and all of that. So I think that's key. And so but when you look at the actual messages that they've put out, it's very inclusive and very all encompassing. So I certainly think that there is plenty of room for interpretation and plenty of room for dialogue. And often the stronger personalities in 12-step and recovery communities that are leaders of particular sponsorship clans or things like that, I think they sometimes overpower the voices of others, you know, wanting to have dialogues around some of this stuff that has wide levels of interpretation. So I certainly am with you for opening up the dialogue, and I thank you for you know, having me on to open up this dialogue. I look forward to more people, you know, learning about the film and learning about, you know, this new recovery advocacy movement that is not AA, but will help to build a bridge to more people into AA or NA or CA or smart recovery or faith-based programs or recovery housing or recovery community centers or recovery schools. And so it is the next frontier for the recovery movement. And we certainly should encourage people to welcome it, because it is coming, whether they like it or not. I mean, the movie is a clear, we are marching in the street now. We are public about our recovery in many places. We have these things happening. So it is happening, and, you know, the more people who are part of it to help guide and shape and make sure that it keeps its integrity, the better. And so I certainly think that we need to get ready for it, because it is where we're here, and, you know, the current events, you know, make us have made it a necessity and a duty for people in recovery to sort of step out into the light and proclaim their recovery and bring our recovery story to the wider mainstream culture.
That's great. I really applaud your efforts like that. I had a sponsee one time, and he was a chronic relapser, Joe Hazleton type. He was a ship's captain on the oil rigs and like that, the huge super tankers and chronic relapser. And I took him under my wing at Post Oak here in Houston. And he liked what I was, when I started the Rum Radio deal and teaching sponsorship and all that. And he said, we're at the point of the sword. And he got really into that, you know, being at the point of the sword. You know, it's the exciting place to be, to try to be part of the engine and still try to remain as part of the group, you know, not to have that overpowering personality, the ability to shrink back and let the principles of recovery find its way, you know, because God's really in charge of the thing anyway.
Right.
So
and
if you give
it, was,
it to God, yeah.
Yeah, and I do have to jump off now. I apologize, but
sure.
it was a great conversation and definitely got me thinking. And I hope it spurs thoughts for other people. And I hope people do check out The Anonymous People. And it's out in theaters now. And you can form your own opinion about the film and have a dialogue with your recovery community. So thank you so much for having me, and best of luck with Rum Radio moving forward.
Oh, thank you, Greg, and thank you for being with us. Thanks again.
All right.
Well,
all right, take care. Have a good day.
Bye. In closing, I have something I wanted to put on. I had written recently. It's called Recovered, and I use a chair that's been recovered, upholstery. It's all about the upholstery. The old stuffing has been replaced with the cushion of grace and a new skin that is scotch-guarded with humility of faith, while the utility of the strong back to service is firmly put in place. This instead of ending up on the junk heap of waste. He who limps is still walking. Ideals have lofty platitudes. Reality is few rise above, and that's why we call it a trudge. The trudge is a shoulder-to-shoulder journey with purpose of conviction. We are exclusively all-inclusive. We are less than kin and more than kind, with no judgment to be found. For love and tolerance is our code, and service to our fellow beings we have found to be the lightest load. So remember, if you're sponsorship, it's rumradio.org. We're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi. We're very popular in Nepal. You know why? They like our yak. 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 300,000 and 400,000 hits to the website. So you find some really good sponsorship information that you can pass on. That's all we ask you to do. There's no money being made, and we're anonymous to the 11th tradition. All we ask you to do is use the tools laid at your feet, open your mouth, and pass it on. And remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good afternoon.